Sierra has all the best active and outdoor brands you need. From athletic stuff, like a full court pickup game, swish, to athletic-ish stuff, like a half mile stroll. Get those steps in. And for morning hikes up the mountain trail, good pace, to nighttime ghost stories from the camping chair. What a twist. Whatever level of active, Sierra loves it all. Head to Sierra or Sierra.com for the brands you want at the prices that let you do it all. From athletic to athletic-ish, Sierra's got it.
This episode is brought to you by Google Health. Stop chasing someone else's definition of health. What matters is what's healthy for you. Google Health offers a new kind of coach built with Gemini for effortless tracking, sleep insights, and holistic coaching tailored to you. Visit googlestore.com to learn more and start a new relationship with your health. Requires Google account, Google Health app, internet, and Google Health premium subscription. Features subject to change. Availability and results vary. Not intended for medical purposes. Works independently of Gemini apps. Check responses for accuracy.
So this week's episode is called When Climate Work Comes at a Cost, Dispatches from the Upside Down. And I think some listeners might appreciate knowing, what is the Upside Down?
Yeah, so the Upside Down is a reference to the show Stranger Things. And for the uninitiated, it's basically this alternate mirror dimension of the real world, but one that is kind of like underground and very dystopian. It's dark, it's scary, it's like decaying. There's like electric storms and really scary monsters, but it is like a mirror, you know, image of the world that the characters live in. And so that felt apt to the moment that we're living in a little bit.
Yeah, especially for a lot of people who are working in climate right now, it can feel like a bizarro world where you start out as a scientist and now you're getting attacked for your research. And, you know, it's not fantasy, it's real scary situations.
Indeed. I'm Ariana Brocious.
I'm Kusha Navidar.
And this is Climate One. It is a really tough time to be working in fields like climate and the environmental sciences. Honestly, when I read the daily headlines, it just feels kind of like a deluge of disaster. There's a lot of bad news out there.
Yes, and it's worth mentioning that climate work isn't completely stalling out, but it's hard to see all of these rollbacks and cuts and canceled projects when we should be making progress.
And climate in particular has kind of seemed to become almost a taboo realm because of the opposition and outright denial and attacks that are coming from many parties, including our own government.
It reminds me of having a scientist come on to a pre-interview for this show, and they were in tears and they said they couldn't risk being on a show called Climate One right now, that it's too much exposure. And by the way, she did end up joining us, but it was a very difficult choice.
And there are many people like her, these real life heroes who are still finding ways to keep their critical work alive, even in the face of cuts and layoffs and personal attacks.
Yeah, and one of the best parts for me of my job right now is getting to talk to some of these people. I'll just say it's very gratifying for me personally to witness someone sharing their story.
This week's episode shines a light on what it's like to be a climate scientist, researcher, or environmental professional trying to do meaningful work in a country with a government and emboldened private interests that increasingly don't want that work.
That's the case for Brent Efron. He worked at the EPA during the Biden administration, and then he found himself at the center of a viral backlash and personal attacks. It started with what seemed like a normal, boring first date. And before we get into that, I wanted to know how Efron found his way into climate work.
So I studied mechanical engineering. When I was in college, Trump won my junior year of college. And I went into mechanical engineering because I thought I wanted to be a rocket scientist and work on spaceships. And when Trump won, I decided I wanted to work on issues a lot closer to home. I wanted to work on saving democracy, partly because I was worried about the climate crisis, but also partly just because I was worried about our country. So after the 2020 election, where I had worked for the Biden campaign, I had the opportunity to go work at EPA and to work in the Office of Policy for the principal advisor to the Administrator for Regulatory Policy. And she was in charge of a lot of the implementation of Biden's climate agenda at that time. And so that was a role where I really got to learn a lot about climate policy.
Let's fast forward to 2024. So the November election happens.
Yeah.
Trump is
elected. Did your job change? Did morale change? Tell me about the impact it had on your work.
Yeah. So in 2024, I was at a different role at EPA. I was working on the Bill and IRA implementation team. So the bipartisan...
And IRA is the Inflation Reduction Act.
Right. Yeah. So the Inflation Reduction Act, the bipartisan infrastructure law, this was $100 billion in funding that EPA had gotten for climate, environment, infrastructure programs across the country. It was about 70 different programs that were funded under these laws at EPA. And my role had been to help make sure that these programs were being implemented effectively. When Trump won, I was very concerned. Trump had run on repealing these laws, on ending these programs. He had run saying that climate change was a hoax, calling what we were doing a scam. Yeah, naturally, that made me very concerned, I think. I saw what we were doing as so great. We were dividing programs that were going to be putting solar panels on low-income houses. We were replacing lead pipes. We were protecting communities that were literally at risk of falling into the ocean. I mean, one of the grants that I know has since been canceled was to protect one of the communities in Alaska that just got hit by a typhoon and have been really destroyed as a result. And we were going to be giving money to protect those very types of communities.
And so there's a wide variety of programs that you were working with and looking at. And around this time, shortly after the election, you go on a date from somebody you meet on Tinder. Tell me about that date.
Sure.
Where did you go? What was it like?
Yeah, sure. So this was someone I met on Tinder. We had messaged a bit for, I think, probably a week or two. And we decided to go on a date. And we went to a bar in DC called Licked. It's a gay bar on U Street. I actually showed up to this date having been already out with some coworkers, just kind of, I don't know, feeling bad for ourselves and for our work. I'm worried about the future. And we'd already been kind of, already put me in this mindset of not feeling so good about what was coming in the coming months at work.
Sure.
When we got to the date, we sat down. And I mean, when I go on a first date, I talk about my life and what's going on.
Yeah.
That's just normally what I do.
Talk I'm about sure my family. In DC, it's kind of like a job interview for a lot of people.
Yeah, it's very, I mean, it is a very DC thing to talk about work. But I also want to talk about my family and my friends. One thing he clearly was most interested in talking about was work. I mean, he asked me about what I did. I told him what I've sort of told you now, that I worked at the EPA, that I'd been working on the implementation of these laws, and that I was concerned. And I made a comment that was something I'd already made at work to some coworkers, that it felt like working at the EPA with the impending Trump administration coming in after everything that he had been saying about wanting to gut the agency and stop climate action and repeal this law that I've been working on. It felt like being on the Titanic, and these programs that I'd worked on, that the funding that I was helping to deploy and ensure was being implemented well, it felt like we were throwing it into lifeboats. I didn't have a good time. I didn't want to go on a second date because he was so interested in talking about work.
So you have the date, you two part ways. You're saying you didn't have a great time. You didn't want to have a second date.
No.
No more talking between each other, I'm guessing.
No, there was not.
And then 2 weeks after the date, you received an email from Project Veritas, which is a far-right group known for producing undercover videos aimed at discrediting mainstream media and liberal organizations. And you got the email and it said, Project Veritas intends to release a video that contains comments made by you to a Project Veritas journalist. Below are some of those quotes. We appreciate any consideration for comment by APM. And the EPA received the same email. Brent, take me back to that moment, if you could. How did it feel when this email arrived?
My heart sank. I mean, I knew what Project Veritas was. I'd heard of them before. And I was so worried about my comments being twisted immediately. It was clear to me that was their intention, was to make this out to be that I'd revealed some sort of something bad. And I was so worried that my words would be twisted even then. I also pretty quickly was worried for my own safety.
Sure. So what did you do?
Well, when we first got the notification that the video was coming out, the way I learned about that was I got a call from my boss who told me that the email had come. I actually hadn't seen it myself first. And I mean, he assured me everything was going to be okay, that we were going to figure out how to get through this. And he wanted to make sure I was okay. And all I could really do at that point was just kind of wait and see what was going to happen. I mean, the email came out about 24 hours before the video was actually released.
So it was a day of just stress. I mean, what would become many days of stress, I'm sure, but it was 24 hours that you had to wait. So the video was released about a day later. We have a clip of it. We didn't edit this. It was edited by Project Veritas. I'd like to just listen to a portion of it, then we can talk about it in a bit. Is that okay to listen to it?
Yeah, let's do it.
Let's take a listen.
Now we're just having to get the money out as fast as possible before they come in and like pop it. It truly feels like we're on the Titanic or throwing like gold bars off the top edge.
Where are the gold bars going to?
Nonprofits, states, tribes. We gave them the money because it was harder. If it was a government run program, they could take the money away.
No.
If Trump won, and because it was a insurance policy against Trump winning.
So Brent, I appreciate you being willing to sit with us and listen to that back. I'm wondering, what's it like for you to listen to it right now after some time away from it?
Well, I think I'm embarrassed. I mean, for anyone to be recorded without their knowing, it's probably pretty embarrassing. But I mean, in that video, I was a bit inebriated and I do regret what I said because I regret what would come after, that my words were twisted and used to justify some actions that I think are really terrible and really harmful to a lot of people. And I mean, it was a date. I think I should have been allowed to say what I said because what I was doing was expressing a political opinion outside of work. But yeah, I mean, every time I hear those comments and I listen to them a few times, I feel embarrassed and I feel regret.
Yeah. And you mentioned that you didn't know what was to come. A lot was to come after that. I mean, Elon Musk shared the clip on his account, formerly known as Twitter, in December with hundreds of millions of followers. And things just kind of blew up from there. I cannot imagine what that is like. So what was that experience like for you after you got all that attention?
It was really hard. Yeah, as you said, pretty soon after that video was released, it was reposted by Elon Musk. Was also tweeted by Lee Zeldin, who at the time had been nominated to lead EPA under the Trump administration. He now is the administrator. Speaker Johnson also mentioned it in a press conference pretty soon after. And I started to receive a lot of hate online in anticipation of this video being released because I had gotten the 24 hours of notice. I had deleted all my social media because I basically been advised that that was likely to happen. But it got pretty scary. I mean, I wasn't seeing what was going on online. My friends were and just telling me not to look. But I also started getting phone calls. And that was really scary.
What did they say?
Well, it's been a while since I listened to those, but I remember being called a traitor. I was told that like I was going to be going to prison. I hadn't deleted my LinkedIn because I was in the process of looking for a job. And
because the administration was about to turn over.
Right.
Yeah.
And I started getting some hateful messages there, similarly calling me a traitor, criminal. Some of them were homophobic. Mm-hmm.
Let's move ahead in time a little bit. It's January. You've left the EPA.
Yeah.
And as you mentioned, Lee Zeldin, the Trump-appointed EPA administrator, posted a video to his Twitter account specifically referencing, and this is a quote, an extremely disturbing video featuring a Biden EPA political appointee talking about how they were tossing gold bars off the Titanic. And he continued, I'll be referring this matter to the Inspector General's office and will work with the Justice Department as well. The days of irresponsibly shoveling boatloads of cash to far-left activist groups in the name of environmental justice and climate equity are over.
Right. So a few days after that video was released, I'm laying in bed. It's a Friday morning when I get a knock at my door. It's two agents from the EPA, Inspector General's office. I don't open the door, but I do talk to them through the threshold. I ask them who they are and why they're here. They say that they want to ask me some questions. And I asked them if I have to answer the questions. They said, I'm not required to. It's totally optional. I tell them I'm not interested and they leave. You know, need their business cards. That afternoon, I'm connected actually with a lawyer, my lawyer, you know, Mark Zaid, who happens to represent a lot of victims of both Project Veritas and some of the other groups that do this type of recording of folks without their consent. A few days later, on Monday, I go out for a run. And when I come back, I find another business card under my door. It's from an FBI agent. It says, please give me a call. I'd like to speak with you. Thank you. I mean, so that's obviously terrifying to have an FBI agent show up at your door. I mean, it's terrifying to have any government agent show up at my door, but for me, that was
for some people, it's terrifying to have anyone up at your door and ring the doorbell. That's a very millennial thing, I think, but yeah.
Yes, this is right. This is also true. It was terrifying to have anyone at my door. Government agent, a whole other level. And an FBI, I put even higher. Actually, around the same time when the FBI agent knocks on my door, I also get a call from a Washington Post reporter, which I don't answer, but I refer him to my lawyer as well. And on February 27th, there was an article that then came out in the Washington Post about this sort of behind-the-scenes investigation that's brewing around this program that the EPA is claiming was the gold bars I was referring to. This was the first real mainstream article to mention me. It shows kind of what was happening at that time. And there was a prosecutor that resigned because they didn't want to be a part of this investigation that was being referred to them. And
so let's make clear here that the EPA's ethics department cleared you of any misconduct in a Justice Department investigation, found no evidence of wrongdoing. And the funds mentioned in the video were approved by Congress through the IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act, which you mentioned. So everything seemed above board after the investigation went through. For you, the aftermath went beyond your time at the EPA. So I'm wondering for you, you know, you're looking back on it now. What have you learned about yourself in the time since you left the EPA?
I think I've learned that I can do hard things, that I'm resilient. It was a really hard year. I mean, after the FBI showed up my door, I then later sat down for questioning with them. And then it seemed like for a while, on like a weekly basis, Minister Zeldin would quote me in press conferences or on podcasts or on TV, and felt like I was living in this crazy world where something that I had said to express just how concerned I was about the Trump administration and how important I thought the work I was doing was had been twisted to mean something entirely different. And I felt very alone. I mean, a lot of people were reaching out to be supportive, but at the end of the day, it was me who was going through it. And it was hard for anyone to really do much because we were up against the Trump administration. But I did get through it. And it also connected me to a lot of other folks who were victims. And it made me feel like I could actually maybe turn this really terrible thing that's happened to me into something to help others.
I want to talk about that for a second because there are others who have been doxxed. They've reached out to you. What do you say to them?
Yeah, well, I try as hard as I can to connect with every victim that I can. Anyone who's been a victim recently. And I want to be a resource. When I went through this, I was sort of figuring out on my own the playbook, figuring out how to get my information pulled off the internet, figuring out how to get a lawyer, figuring out how to respond to press, how to deal with that.
Figuring out how to get a job at the same time. Let's not forget.
Yes. Figuring out how to get a
job.
Exactly. How to communicate this in interviews, how to communicate it at all, how to talk about it in networking and interviews and just in general. And in the end, I was able to get a job and I love what I'm doing now.
Yeah. Tell me about it. What's your new position? What are you doing?
Yeah. So I'm continuing to work on climate policy. I work at the Environmental Policy Innovation Center, which is a nonprofit. And I'm doing permitting reform, trying to figure out ways to make the ways that we approve clean energy projects, transportation, housing, other infrastructure projects that are so important in fighting climate change and in advancing climate solutions for adapting to climate change, make it easier for these projects to be built.
It enlivens me to hear you talk passionately about solutions after everything you've been through. How does it feel for you now to be able to talk so passionately about solutions in the climate space?
It's a relief. I remain so worried about climate change. It's relieving to be able to work on something that I care so much about, whether it's the climate crisis, it's protecting democracy, making government just work for people. And I felt for a long time this year that I was not able to be helpful anymore, that my words have been twisted in a way that I wouldn't get to play a part in helping to address these problems that really concern me. And the fact that I'm able to work on this again, that I feel like I'm helping to deploy solutions, it really, really feels meaningful and really, really feels good.
Mm. Before I let you go, can I ask about your dating life?
Sure.
I mean, as somebody who has dated on the apps, I know it can be tough, and I feel like you have so much more reason to say that. Are you dating again? Is that something that is on your radar?
Yeah, I am dating again. It was actually really important to me that I start dating again pretty actually soon after, well, maybe a few months after this all happened, as a way to heal and to remind myself that I could trust strangers again. And yeah, I'm going on dates. There's no one special, I guess, at the moment, but I'm going on dates. There's some more Googling now to make sure I know who I'm meeting. But yeah, I'm happy to say I'm back on the apps.
Brent Efron is Senior Manager for Permitting Innovation. He really likes talking about permits at the Environmental Policy Innovation Center. Brent, thanks so much for coming on, for sharing your story.
Thank you so much for having me. It was great.
We reached out to Project Veritas for comment, and in an email they said, quote, "Project Veritas upholds the core principle of the public's right to know in our journalism." The email went on to say that Mr. Efron's candid remarks about the Biden administration's EPA rushing $50 billion in taxpayer funds out the door raised significant concerns. Project Veritas also noted that an appeals court in September ruled that the Trump administration could terminate the grants in question and that the gold bars video was damning evidence.
Coming up, a lawyer who advised on laws to make corporate polluters pay gets targeted by groups linked to fossil fuel companies.
And it's required an enormous amount of time. I mean, I've spent more hours dealing with this lawsuit at this point than I did performing the pro bono work that led to it.
That's up next when Climate One continues.
When you need to build up your team to handle the growing chaos at work, use Indeed Sponsored Jobs. It gives your job post the boost it needs to be seen and helps reach people with the right skills, certifications, and more. Spend less time searching and more time actually interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need a hiring hero? This is a job for Indeed Sponsored Jobs.
This episode is brought to you by Google Chrome. You think you know a browser, but Gemini and Chrome? That's new. It can help you with practically anything on the web, like restoring a vintage motorcycle from a 50-page restoration blog, or finally break down that long article you've had open for weeks. Gemini and Chrome is here for it. Ready to make anything online make sense? There's no place like Chrome. Check responses, setup required, compatibility and availability varies, 18+.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. Listening to this podcast instead of doom scrolling? Smart move. Another smart move? Getting help from one of State Farm's 19,000 local agents when you choose to bundle home and auto. Bundling, just another way to save with the Personal Price Plan. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
Lawyer and scholar Rachel Rothschild has become a leading expert in climate superfund laws. Recently, she and her work have come under intense scrutiny by organizations linked to fossil fuel interests. And you may be asking yourself, what are climate superfunds?
The way the state climate superfunds are supposed to work is they're going to impose fees on what are called responsible parties, which are very large fossil fuel companies. Listeners might think of a company like ExxonMobil or Chevron. They're likely to be responsible parties under this law. And the states are going to require them to pay a portion of the costs to adapt to climate change and help offset the harms to natural resources and public health that states are going to experience.
I live in New York City, so for the past year and a half or so, there's been a lot of discussion about climate superfund laws and what's called polluters pay. So are those the same thing?
So the polluter pay concept undergirds the state climate superfund laws in the following way. So the polluter pays concept is very old. It actually goes all the way back to the 1970s when some of our first environmental legislation was passed at the federal level, not just in the United States, by the way, but in other industrialized countries around the world. And the idea was that those who've most profited from a particular industrial activity should be the ones responsible for helping to pay to remedy the harm that results from that activity, right? Because environmental problems are really market failures. There are companies externalizing, socializing the costs of their activity and privatizing all of the profits, all of the benefits. And so the polluter pays model makes sure the companies are contributing to remedying the harms that they're causing to the rest of society.
The collateral damage, some might say.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. And so Vermont became the first state to pass a law like this. It was in May 2024. New York followed December 2025. How did you support the passage of the law?
So when I was at Policy Integrity, my job was really to think through how to do this in a way that's consistent with the U.S. Constitution and the cases and legal precedent that exist. And so since thinking through some of those legal issues, I've helped advise different environmental groups that are interested in this legislation. I've given public testimony to various state legislatures about these laws, and I just tried to make myself available as a resource for people who might have questions about the legal issues involved.
Mm. So being like kind of a thought leader, let me call you a thought leader.
Thanks.
You're somebody who people go to ask about how to draft these kinds of policies. And you're doing a lot of this work at the University of Michigan. Is that right?
So I started it when I was at the Institute for Policy Integrity, when I was a legal fellow there. And I worked on it, did the bulk of my work initially there. And then once I transitioned to my faculty position at the university, I've continued doing this work pro bono for some of the environmental groups I was working with before, but also other environmental groups that I've started working with since I became faculty here.
Well, the reason that I bring that up, as I'm sure you can anticipate, is to delve into the pushback that you've received as a part of this work. I mean, shortly after the Superfund law was passed in Vermont, the University of Michigan got a letter, right, from a group called Government Accountability and Oversight, which we'll refer to as GAO, and they're seeking your emails related to climate superfunds. Tell me about that. What were they looking for? What were they asking the University of Michigan for?
So just to clarify a little bit on the timeline, so the request for my private communications with environmental groups by the Government Accountability and Oversight Organization started coming in after I'd been on the faculty here for about a year and a half. So I think it was around February of 2024, if I'm getting that timeline right. Yes. And they were requesting my communications with some of the environmental organizations that have worked on this legislation and that I had been providing pro bono legal advice to since I've been a faculty member here. And the university denied those requests. Their belief and my belief is that this is work I was doing pro bono, external to my role at the university. But the organization, just after the Vermont law was passed, sued the University of Michigan, saying that the university needed to turn over my private email communications with environmental groups under the Michigan State Freedom of Information Law.
So the FOIA, the Freedom of Information Act, was what they were using. Why could they use that on the University of Michigan?
So the University of Michigan, because it's a public university, is considered by the courts here. It's not explicitly in the statute, but there's a lot of cases that say that the university, because it receives taxpayer funding, it's a public institution, the university itself is considered subject to the state Freedom of Information Law. Now, how to interpret that when it comes to individual faculty or when it comes to faculty's external work is something that I think there hasn't been a lot of litigation on. And so my case is really testing the limits of how far these Freedom of Information Act requests can go.
Mm. For me, at least, the Freedom of Information Act has a very specific place in my mind because I started experiencing it when I worked in a political administration as a speechwriter. And the ethics department told us that all of our records were available under the Freedom of Information Act. Most people think of FOIA as like a real strong tool of democracy to democratize the access of information. What do you think about that in this context? Like for listeners who might think of FOIA as one thing, is it that or is it multiple? Do people use it in all different ways?
That's a great question. I should first acknowledge I have used the Freedom of Information Act myself. So as a scholar and a researcher who's studied environmental regulation, I've used Freedom of Information Act requests in a lot of my scholarship to try to better understand agency decision-making and understand how different issues have affected the regulatory process. So I'm certainly very pro-FOIA in the sense that it can be really important and useful, as you said, as a transparency tool, kind of small d democratic tool so that the public can know what the government is doing. What's different in the context of universities and scholars is that, at least in my view, most people don't think of professors as part of the government, right? We're certainly funded by taxpayers, but we don't have the same kind of role as a government official or decision maker. And so there's been differences across states, and there's certainly been a lot of public debate about using FOIA in a way that was never really intended by a lot of legislatures. And it hadn't really come up as a big issue in a lot of states, I think, until probably about the last 15 years or so with the proliferation of electronic communications. That's been something that the FOIA laws didn't quite anticipate, right? There's just a lot more written communications we now have because of email. And some groups who don't like faculty's research or don't like the particular viewpoints of faculty have started to use these laws to go after professors whose work they're opposed to. So the more common one we're seeing nowadays is certainly corporate groups or corporate funded organizations using this to go after faculty who are researching issues that might be problematic in the corporation's view to their bottom line, which I think is a real weaponization of FOIA and not how the law was originally intended to be used.
And you mentioned groups. The group in this case asking for that information is GAO. A part that kind of confused me a little bit when I was learning about this is that GAO, the G stands for government, but it is not a government organization, right?
No, they're not a government organization, and they've changed their name several times. So I think they used to be the American Tradition Institute, then I think they were the Energy and Environment Institute or something like that. So they've kind of reconfigured themselves over time. But yeah, that's their current title.
Why do you think they wanted your emails?
I think the biggest reason they want my emails is because they're hoping to find something in them to discredit the state climate Superfund laws. So currently, there are lawsuits being filed against both Vermont and New York, the two states that have passed these laws. And in the complaints that were initially filed by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the American Petroleum Institute, those are the industry groups that are suing Vermont and New York, those complaints cite actually documents that the GAO has FOIA'd from various other governmental organizations. And so when I saw that, it initially, you know, struck me that, wow, that must be what they're hoping to get out of this, right? Is to just try to find something in my emails that they're then going to be able to use and cite as a way to attack the laws themselves. And that could take different forms, I suppose. I'm not sure exactly what they think they're going to find, but from at least reading some of the things they posted publicly, they do seem to have in mind that I am part of some green conspiracy type thing, and perhaps they're hoping that they'll find something to discredit me and thus discredit the laws by association. I think another reason they want to see my emails and have filed this lawsuit is because opposing something like this as a faculty member is incredibly time-consuming and stressful and takes a lot of resources and energy that I could be spending doing on other things, but that I now have to spend kind of dealing with this lawsuit. And so it's a tax in some ways on the people who want to do pro bono work for environmental organizations and in some ways make an example out of me to show other people this is what will happen to you if that will kind of come after you in this way if you do this work. And I am really sad about that aspect of this because I do think that it has had that effect that I've seen in some ways on other environmental law scholars. And it's had a real chilling effect on my ability to do the pro bono legal work that I want to be doing.
It goes without saying that it is a lot to deal with. I mean, not just being embroiled in a lawsuit and asking your institution that employs you to send records of you, but also GAO is seeking to depose you, right? And that's happening shortly after this episode is publishing on November 7th. So, you know, when you talk about the personal tax on doing this kind of work, it is very real, it sounds like. But what's it been like for you personally, for you professionally, to go through this?
It's been really, really difficult. It's taken an enormous toll on me in terms of my time, right? So I'm a junior faculty member at the University of Michigan, which means I'm on the tenure track, supposed to be getting ready to go up for tenure in a few years. I should be really focusing on my scholarship, becoming the best researcher I can be, the best teacher I can be. And instead, I've had to manage this, and it's required an enormous amount of time. I mean, I've spent more hours dealing with this lawsuit at this point than I did performing the pro bono work that led to it. And so to keep up with my other professional obligations to do my job at the university, it's meant time away from my family. It's meant canceled vacations, missed time on the weekends with my children. And that's taken a real toll on me and my family, right? Because that's time that I won't get back. I would also say I've been really heartbroken at the way this has affected my ability to work with certain organizations that I previously worked with, because they're really worried about getting caught up in a lawsuit like this, given how horrible it is to go through. So the hardest example of this for me is with my prior employer and where I'm an affiliated scholar, the Institute for Policy Integrity, which is the organization where I started this work.
Started, yeah.
Yeah, on state climate superfunds. So, you know, my relationship with policy integrity goes back all the way to law school. I was a student in the clinic there. I was so excited to work there as a legal fellow, you know, so excited to stay on as an affiliated scholar. But when things started escalating with this case back in March of this year, you know, I had a conversation with the current director there, who basically told me that the Institute was considering ending my affiliated scholar status with the organization because they were really worried about their litigation risk and exposure by working with me. And so, you know, that was just absolutely heartbreaking. Absolutely heartbreaking to sort of think that my ability to do this work might be compromised with the Institute because of this lawsuit.
And also just people that you trust or have built a relationship with at a pivotal part of your life distancing themselves from you, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is where I got trained as an environmental lawyer. I mean, this is where I kind of made my career initially. And people there I considered not just people I went to work with every day, but my friends. And people I really cared about. And so to not be able to talk to them, to have this kind of big wall put up, has been really hard.
Yeah. Were you expecting it?
No, not at all. Not at all. I mean, I think it hasn't been the reaction of everyone. Uh-huh. So, you know, I have had some environmental organizations pull me closer in this experience as this has all transpired, want to make sure we, you know, just take steps to formalize our relationship even more, to come up with better ways to work on things together that would be, you know, more protected. And so I've had that experience with groups like the Center for Progressive Reform, where I was recently elected a member scholar, you know, and other environmental organizations that I do consulting work with. So that has been heartwarming, that, you know, I have had people who have said, you know, we want to stand with you and support you, and we're going to do everything we can to help you through this and make sure that you can continue to do this public pro bono work that you want to do. So it hasn't been everyone, but this is not a unique phenomenon. I mean, we're seeing similar things with law firms that have come under attack, right? Some law firms have struck deals with the Trump administration when they faced scrutiny. Others have decided to push back. And I know that these are really hard decisions that people have to make. For me, I'm just very grateful that I have a number of environmental groups that are choosing to kind of push back with me.
Yeah. So I'm sure that you've experienced a lot that most listeners, I certainly haven't. Going through this experience, has anything surprised you?
I guess I would say One thing that I hope to share with listeners is just how scary it is to be doing this work right now, given the world we're living in, given the threats that a lot of people have received. So when I decided to come forward publicly about what was happening with this lawsuit, I confided in trusted advisors in the environmental legal community about the fact that I was going to kind of come forward publicly. And I got the strong suggestion and advice that I needed threat monitoring because of concerns that have emerged within the environmental community about security and people's just basic physical safety. And I did receive threat monitoring pro bono from a democracy protection group because of concerns along those lines. And that was really surprising and scary to think that that was something that I needed. I'm just a professor. Don't consider myself a public official in a way, right?
Yeah.
Somebody would need that kind of monitoring.
What is threat monitoring? Like they look for your name on social media sites or?
Yeah, it's monitoring kind of very right wing, in my case, websites, forums, chats to make sure that no one is making any threats against me.
Wow. What part of that surprised you that you would be in this position to begin with?
Yeah, I guess because I've always been somebody who's kind of been the nerd in the room. Like I'm just the person who kind of sits behind the desk and, you know, works on the research and tries to help think about things deeply and give my best advice as a scholar and an expert. The idea that someone like myself would need that kind of protection is really, really surprising to me. And no, I never really thought of myself as somebody who would take on this kind of public profile in the way that I have.
Yeah. Scary. That's the word that you used.
Yeah. It is super scary.
I was going to ask, why aren't you afraid to speak out? But I think that question needs to change to why not give in to the fear, I suppose, and stop.
So I don't really know how to be any other way than to kind of stand my ground when this kind of thing happens. If I'm thinking about what I'm going to regret in my life, if I sort of try to fast forward 10, 20 years from now, I think I would deeply regret not standing up for important principles and values that I have. And so, you know, if I'm going to be able to live with myself and sleep well at night, for me personally, it's just really, really important to stand up for myself and for what I think is the right thing to do in this situation. Yeah, I come from a family of refugees. My grandparents came here from Nazi Germany in the years in and around World War II and after the war. And I thought a lot about my grandparents as I've been going through this experience and what they sacrificed and what they had to endure in what were far scarier circumstances than what I'm dealing with, as frightening as they are. And so I kind of try to think about ways of acting consistently with their values and how they would want me to kind of stand up in this particular moment.
Yeah. And I imagine having that connection can be very affirming, right?
Yes, absolutely.
How about as a teacher?
I think a lot about wanting to be a good role model for my students. I've had a number of students who said to me, especially since learning about this lawsuit after it was reported in the media, Professor, I look up to you and I want to kind of follow in your footsteps and do this work. And so I take very seriously my responsibility to set an example for the people who are going to come after me and the students who want to go out and be environmental lawyers to try to make sure that I am brave and show courage, even if it's hard and scary sometimes.
Rachel Rothschild is assistant professor at the University of Michigan Law School. Rachel, thank you so much for coming on with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
We reached out to the Government Accountability and Oversight Organization for comment, but they did not respond. Coming up, understanding climate obstruction.
Who's blocking action on climate change? Who are their allies? What are their networks? What are their tactics, and how can they be pushed back against?
That's up next when Climate One continues.
Tomorrow morning is knocking. Stock your fridge now. How about a creamy mocha frappuccino drink? Or a sweet vanilla? Smooth caramel maybe? Or a white chocolate mocha? Whichever you choose, delicious coffee awaits. Find Starbucks frappuccino drinks wherever you buy your groceries.
Chronic migraine is 15 or more headache days a month, each lasting 4 hours or more.
Botox, onabotulinum toxin A, prevents headaches in adults with chronic migraine before they start. It's not for those with 14 or fewer headache days a month. It prevents, on average, 8 to 9 headache days a month versus 6 to 7 for placebo.
Prescription Botox is injected by your doctor. Effects of Botox may spread hours to weeks after injection, causing serious symptoms. Alert your doctor right away, as difficulty swallowing, speaking, breathing, eye problems, or muscle weakness can be signs of a life-threatening condition. Patients with these conditions before injection are at highest risk. Side effects may include allergic reactions, neck and injection site pain, fatigue, and headache. Allergic reactions can include rash, welts, asthma symptoms, and dizziness. Don't receive Botox if there's a skin infection. Tell your doctor your medical history, muscle or nerve conditions, including ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, myasthenia gravis or Lambert-Eaton syndrome, and medications, including botulinum toxins, as these may increase the risk of serious side effects.
Why wait? Ask your doctor, visit BotoxChronicMigraine.com, or call 1-800-44-BOTOX to learn more.
Got a Sam's Cafe pizza order up. You know the best part about this spicy Italian sausage? I voted for this topping. Yeah, just another perk of being a member. Come join us. Sam's Club.
Environmental studies and sociology professor J. Timmons Roberts leads the Climate Social Science Network, an international group of 800 scholars focused on climate obstruction. He also runs the Climate and Development Lab, a student faculty program at Brown University. A few years ago, his lab began to release a series of reports revealing connections between groups who opposed offshore wind development and climate denial think tanks and the fossil fuel industry.
A lot of the groups that have sprung up are really coastal property owners. And what we found out was that a group in Delaware, a conservative far-right think tank, had sent letters to 37,000 front row property owners, commercial and mostly residential, and said, you know, these things are huge. They're going to destroy your tourism and your view and your property values. And I think a lot of the people freaked out when they saw that. People saw, for example, survey ships out there trying to figure out exactly where they should put the turbines and where to put the cables and so on, just, you know, to map the nature of the ocean floor, the continental shelf. So there were strange boats out there, and people wanted to find out what they were and went online. And there online, of course, is a massive amount of information, many negative claims about the impacts of offshore wind on the marine ecosystem, on shipping, on fishing, on human health, tourism, the economy, and on and on.
Robert's team found that a lot of that information, or misinformation, was being supplied by groups with ties to the fossil fuel industry.
We have never claimed that these groups are receiving money from big oil and so on, but we are claiming that they are receiving some benefits from organizations that are receiving money from big oil. There is what we call a this information subsidy, or we could say sort of a capacity subsidy. That is, they're receiving in-kind services of different sorts, whether it's talking points, you know, memes, social media posts, material that they can put into their PowerPoints and websites, Facebook groups, about these negative impacts of wind that are often, in my professional opinion, exaggerated or quite sensationalized claims about wind's impacts. They're also receiving lawyerly help. They're receiving connections to hire PR firms and, you know, consultants. So just to say, there's a lot of different sort of services that were provided by these think tanks and actors who were fighting renewables for quite a long time before these local groups came along.
And in his opinion, the level of opposition to offshore wind feels out of proportion with the actual impacts of the turbines, which are located 15 miles off the coast.
You know, I went down to the coast of Rhode Island a couple of days ago with my wife just to see the ones that are being built. The main wind farm down there, Revolution Wind, is getting to be almost complete. And you stand on the beach, and the beach is so beautiful. It is really a glorious coastline. And you hold out your arm, and your thumbnail, the height of these turbines is less than like a third of your thumbnail at arm's length. And then I held up a toothpick at arm's length, and it's far less diameter, whatever. It's smaller than a toothpick, you know, a third of the height of your thumbnail. And I just think we can live with these things. You know, we had done research earlier in my lab about how Rhode Island could decarbonize, how it could do its part on climate change to the level that the science tells us is necessary. And we did this study back in 2019 with a consultant from the Stockholm Environment Institute, a leading energy modeling group. And what we found in rerunning those models to try to be more aggressive, more ambitious, to try to actually live up to the science, was that we could decarbonize in southern New England and Rhode Island specifically, and that the on-the-shelf available technology that would get us there the most quickly and affordably was offshore wind. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of wind. We have a beautiful shallow water continental shelf close to the electrical grid, close to the population centers. It really is a fantastic resource. We could be producing extra electricity and exporting it to nearby states. You know, and this is a tiny state that imports $3 to $5 billion a year in fossil fuels. Why wouldn't we want to produce our energy here and cleanly? So, you know, yes, it's energy infrastructure. It will have impacts, as any energy infrastructure does. But I, you know, my feeling is that these are people who have never had to live near energy infrastructure. They're not like the people where I lived in Louisiana for 10 years who are living literally a chain link fence in your backyard away from a massive oil refinery, which is, you know, exploding, leaking, smelling, making noises, flaring, and so on in the middle of the night on the weekend.
Most recently, your group has released a report documenting the legal support in particular. And Marzulla Law, one of the five networks that you talk about in this legal entanglements report, sent a letter to Brown demanding that the research you published be redacted. What was your reaction when that letter came in?
Yeah, I was a little surprised, to say the least, especially because many of the things that they were complaining about, we had published 2.5 years ago. This letter came on August 11th. I was forwarded by the general counsel. It came directly to Brown University. It wasn't sent to me. And it was, as you said, demanding that Brown take down the Climate and Development Lab, my lab's research on this organization. You know, we all looked at this letter and said, well, this looks like some other threatening letters we've gotten in the past. And just to be clear, the ones in the past also demanded that, you know, they take down my research from the website. And Brown has each time said, this is academic freedom. We don't tell faculty what to do research about, nor what to say. So it didn't look like anything new until reading it more carefully. And then there was like two things that were new. The first being a threat of all the science funding of the whole university. So Brown University is a leading global university, you know, globally ranked, and does some really cutting edge research. And so in the letter, they said they were also going to be sending coordinated reports to the National Science Foundation, the Department of Energy, and the Mellon Foundation. So public and private funders of research and work in the university. And, you know, that we should take down these reports and apologize to the organizations that are being discussed, described in the reports to the best of our ability. And also, each of these reports has a disclaimer on it, which says this is not coming from Brown University. This is from a lab, which is largely undergraduate-led research, and the statements don't represent the university, that they're an initial phase of research. And anyway, we're doing our best. And the other new thing was that it came from this Marzulla Law company, which we had actually already been doing all this research on their relationship with the offshore wind groups and looking back at their history. And so we had a lot to say about that, and we had this report almost ready to go. So when we got this letter, I said, we need to get this report out because it's documenting exactly what they're saying is not true, and that is that they're linked to networks that include fossil fuel industries.
What does Marzullo Law stand to lose by having this report out there?
Yeah, I think like public relations firms, law firms would like to sort of linger in the background. They're the best ones are the ones that, you know, the focus is on the plaintiff or the defendant, not on the lawyers. But they're a really important part of this whole network. And we had some in the original report, the one called Against the Wind. And we also had this Marzullo Law group in the first one. And then we decided we needed to understand them much, much more, because it seemed to me that they are crucial pieces of this network. They have experience, they have connections, they have often, you know, they can say they're providing, you know, legal services even-handedly, but this Marzullo Law has represented some of the most extractive is the neutral word for it. Some of the most rapacious companies in America as they attempted to roll back the major environmental laws of the United States. Everything, you know, from the Endangered Species Act to marine mammals and other things that would get in the way of extraction of oil and gas, lumber, ranching, and so on. And we're members of a climate denialist coalition.
Yeah. So I want to put this in context. You know, this letter sent by the law firm, they claim that your report is false and injurious. And this is happening at a moment, a pretty fraught moment for universities. There's a ton of pressure being put on them and their funding streams, particularly federal funding, by the Trump administration. So, you know, Brown defended your work as they have in the past, but does this give you concern, this letter intended to basically silence you?
Yeah, of course. I mean, there was some sleep that has been lost, but that doesn't mean, you know, one can back down. And I think, it's a reflection of emboldened actors believing they can bully universities who are indeed in a vulnerable position right now, very vulnerable. Why not throw in this threat of, attacking the funding of the whole university because they want to get what they can? I will note, it's been about 7 weeks or so since Brown responded to this letter from Marzullo Law, and we've not heard anything.
You know, this sounds upsetting, frankly. I mean, to be threatened, to have the work you're doing be challenged, the funding sources of the university itself be threatened. You sound really calm and even keeled about it. So do you get upset? Are you, you know, do you get worked up about this?
Yeah, I do if I let myself worry about it too much, for sure. I'm calm because, well, I'm an old white native-born tenured guy who's going into phased retirement. I mean, I'll be direct that I'll go forward with this work somehow. I do worry about my colleagues if they really did come after Brown's research funding. I think that's just pitiful to threaten a whole university, to threaten unrelated research because you don't like what one professor is saying and his undergraduate students working in his lab. That's really sad. And I think that the people who are bringing these should be ashamed of doing that. And so I guess I feel like when people understand the full story, it's pretty clear that this is not going to hold up. If we live in a country of laws, this will be thrown out as a slap suit if there is a lawsuit. There's a law in Rhode Island called an anti-SLAPP law,
which SLAPP stands for, go ahead.
Strategic Lawsuit Against Public Participation, mm-hmm. which is basically was enacted in 1995 because they were seeing a lot of people being harassed for saying things that other people didn't like.
So right now, climate action and academic freedom are frankly under attack by the federal government. You work with this lab and a lot of undergraduates, and I'm wondering how you talk about this moment and their careers with them in in this time, especially given everything we've already talked about that you've been facing?
I'm very proud of the students. I'm at the other end of my career from where they are. And I think it would be very unsettling to see the just all-out attack on all this important work. Of course, it's disheartening for me to see decades of efforts to deal seriously with the issue of climate change. We put this off at our peril, of course, and it's going to bite us. It's going to bite us badly. And these are the students are the ones who will feel it the most. But all of us are already experiencing climate change, and it's just going to get worse. The students are really confronting it, and they understand that this time is pivotal, and they're not giving up. And I think they are very excited about this work. And I think they feel just like I do, that there's real therapy in taking action, in doing something, in trying to be useful to address the issue of climate change. This focus on who's blocking action on climate change, how they're doing it, what are their discourses, who are their allies, what are their networks, what are their, their tactics, and how can they be pushed back against? So that's what our whole global organization called the Climate Social Science Network is focused on, that work. And we now have over 800 scholars in 50 different countries working on understanding who's blocking action on climate change.
Yeah, and I want to note for listeners that you have co-edited a book that was just released, documents a lot of this climate obstruction, and the book's called Climate Obstruction, A Global Assessment. And for listeners who want to know more, it really details all the different industries that are involved in some form of climate obstruction. So as we wrap up, I want to return to this letter and the kind of threat of lawsuit from Marzullo Law. It does appear for now that they may not actually end up filing a lawsuit. But how do these kinds of threats affect the work you do, even if they don't file a lawsuit?
I have to say, we are very careful. I have all of our work that might be attacked. I have it run by a defamation lawyer. There's also a pretty wonderful group called the Climate Science Legal Defense Fund, which is here set up just for cases like this to help academics and researchers deal with attacks from those who don't like what we're saying. And I have them look over work as well. Whenever there are these threatening letters, I talk to our university's general counsel. I also send them our work before we put it up on the website. I add these disclaimers that I've mentioned before. But have I stopped? No. And will I stop? No. In fact, we're learning. Each of these attacks really teaches us some things about the organizations, about how they work, about their connections. We need those who believe we need to advance climate action to understand their opposition. Mm-hmm. People really were quite naive that more science, good information, good public policy, and good technology would lead to us just solving the climate change crisis. But that's not been the case, because we've really failed to understand those who have an interest in us not solving the problem. I'm a social scientist. I really see the opportunity to learn from all the input that we can collect. And so I see it sort of as an opportunity to see it on the inside.
Jay Timmons-Roberts is a professor of environmental studies and sociology at Brown University and the executive director of the Climate Social Science Network. Thank you so much for joining us on Climate One and sharing your research with us.
Thanks, Ariana. I appreciate it. And it's been very good to be with you.
We asked Marzullo Law for comment, but they did not respond. All right, we have reached the end of our show. And as usual, it's time for one more thing that's on our minds this week. Kusha, what have you got?
I want to shout out the Climate One newsletter. It comes out every week. Last week, I saw a pretty cool chart about the size of the global e-bike market. Two things about it. Number one, this year, the estimated current market size of e-bikes around the world is just shy of $70 billion. In 5 years, it's going to be north of $113 billion.
Wow.
Yeah, big jump. The other thing I wanted to point out, where in the world, what region accounts for the largest share? It is Asia Pacific.
more than North America, more than Europe, Asia Pacific.
Yeah, that's great. And I love the reference to our chart of the week, which is in our newsletter every week. And if you want to get that in your inbox and see what fascinating thing we've found, sign up for our newsletter at climateone.org.
Climate One is a production of the Commonwealth Club. Our team includes Greg Dalton, Brad Marshland, Jenny Park, Austin Colon, Megan Basilia, Ariana Brocious, and Rachel Lacey. Our theme music is by George Young. I'm Kusha Navidar.
When it comes to my policy, Farmers gives it to me straight, so there's no surprises.
It's your coverage. You should never be confused.
You hear that? An insurance provider with a conscience.
We're a choir, but yes, we have that too.
Straightforward coverage you can literally understand. That's what you get when
you have Farmers. Bum, 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 bum.
Learn more at Farmers.com. Underwritten by Farmers Truck or Fire Insurance Exchanges or Affiliate. Products not available in every state.